live from the Skyline Studios, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive on a snowy Chicago day. It's me, Anna D., Anna DeVlantis. And looking out here from our studios on the 18th floor, it does, as Ryan Burrow, newsman Ryan Burrow, pointed out, looks like a snow globe. It really does. It's got that effect right now. So kind of pretty. But I guess if you're driving in it, maybe
what's weird is
more.
The snowflakes by my window are going up. I thought snow fell.
Oh, they're kind of, the wind is blowing them upwards.
It's a conspiracy, I tell you.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's because we learned about the doomsday clock that you just told us. That was refreshing, wasn't it?
When the snowflakes start going up, we inch even closer to the end of days.
Go check with the University of Chicago. Yeah. We need to know. Have we gone up a minute? Jeez. All right. Well, if you're driving in the snow right now, it's a little tricky sometimes. I know they're clearing. The roads downtown look good. It looks very good by now, although it's been falling steadily, and that's always the toughest stuff to clear from the roads. But here's a question for you. Do you have an iPass? Because later in the show, we're going to talk about iPasses. 6.8 million iPasses in the state of Illinois. Now, that includes commercial vehicles and things like that. So a lot of people have these. And there's this push to say, hey, should they be allowed to subpoena your iPass in all kinds of court cases? Because right now you hear about them in divorce cases. You hear about the police get them in criminal cases. And they go to a judge usually, or there's subpoenas issued in civil cases. But how available should they be? Should someone be able to tell where you are, how long you spent there, when you passed through, your movements, basically? Should all that be available just for a simple civil case? There's a lawmaker who says, no, that doesn't make sense. So we're going to talk about that. Did you ever have your records subpoenaed? Did you like that? Was that okay? I know in contentious divorce cases, they do, it comes up. How long were you there? Did you take the kids to soccer? I mean, you know, it's just, it can get down to the nitty-gritty of your exact location at every moment.
When you think about all the devices that we have that can record where we are at any given moment, and all
like,
the data.
That's, like, I give up kind of thing. Right. You know, it's going to happen anyway. But these are ones you can directly get.
True.
And it limits,
yes.
it lists exactly where right. you are and when you pass through these things. So fascinating issue. And I wonder how people feel about that, especially if it's happened to you. You know, it tells a lot about you, right? Also, the Burnham plan, we've heard about that, but the State Street plan is something that's being considered right now. Major overhaul to State Street. What should it look like in the new decade and beyond? For the new decade, I should say.
Is that my cue, Anna? State Street. Great Street. Okay, sorry.
It does stick in your mind, doesn't it? It is the Great Street, and we'd like to keep it great, and you don't want it to sort of go the way of some shopping malls that you see. And you see this all throughout the Chicago area, see it all across America right now. Shopping malls reinventing themselves for the new digital age. They're competing with internet shopping. Mm-hmm. Tough to do, because you have to pay for bricks and mortar, and you see a number of stores close who are trying to fight that. And then you see some who are sort of becoming that experiential answer. So they say, make your store experiential. What does that mean? You look at the Starbucks on the Mag Mile, the largest Starbucks in the world that open up.
That must mean that it must be, it has to be Instagrammable. There's got to be something there someone can take a photo in front of, or there's got to be an experience or something they can get only exclusively at the brick and mortar location.
You can see how the coffee beans are roasted. Is that enough? I don't know. You get a latte, and then on top of it, you can sort of feel and see everything that's going on with Starbucks. So that's an idea of it. Some of these retail stores are offering up cocktails while you shop and live music, stuff
that
like
works
that.
At the grocery store when you try to go shopping, but then you end up at the wine bar for a while.
I remember Mariano's used to do that. I don't know if they still do that, but you'd see a lot of people with mm-hmm. their fancy drinks just walking around and shopping, and they looked really relaxed. I mean, it looked like it was working for them. We also the person who's leading the charge on that, the director of the organization that's going to submit the new State Street plan, she's coming on the show to discuss what it is they're looking at, how they envision it. It hasn't all been decided yet. There's going to be that plan and some public meetings and some other things going on to really have it take shape. But she's going to tell us where they are with the whole thing. What are they thinking? You know, it's an interesting thing to do. Tough task, I think. But she's got some ideas. She'll share them with us. Also, one of the stars of NBC's Chicago Fire will be on the show, David Eigenberg. I know, G, you know him from Sex and the City.
Oh, loved him.
I didn't really watch Sex and the City, but he was Miranda's guy.
Yes, and they had on again, off again. He was the bartender, and of course, she's very ambitious. She was partner at her law firm, mm-hmm. and it just seemed as though they weren't going to be together. And then there was an affair as well down the road after they got married, but they ended up being together forever.
Boy, you know your Sex and the City.
love of each other's lives.
Well, I like him as the gritty lieutenant on Chicago Fire, because to me, he feels like the kind of character that resembles the most a real Chicago firefighter, not the airbrushed kind of perfect hair guy. He's the guy who comes in with like the fun thing to say, or he gives the other guys a hard time. And he's like, he's that guy.
To me, I totally agree with you. He is salt of the earth. He seems like a real Chicagoan.
Yeah, but he's doing something, speaking of real Chicagoans and first responders in particular, he's doing something really cool this weekend, an event he's getting involved with to help first responders all across Chicago, all across Illinois, really. He's doing something awesome, and he's going to talk about that, something you're welcome to go to if you'd like to go. And then what's happening over at the Chicago Tribune, if you've been on social media, I've seen this, a number of reporters are tweeting about getting these letters, these buyout letters, as the hedge fund that took over a third interest in Tribune Publishing, known for gutting newsrooms, known for making massive cuts, seems to be delivering on its historical promises. And a number of people, you know, they're bracing over there for their colleagues marching out of the building, holding their cardboard boxes. And, you know, it's just it's what happens next? I mean, how can you cover it with the amount of staff that they're going to have when it's all said and done? Heidi Stevens is a Tribune columnist, and she's going to come by and talk about that. You think about the role of journalism in the city, and you think about over the years, the number of things they've exposed, the number of ways they've been a watchdog for government and held our leaders and public officials accountable. And then you think, okay, well, what happens now? So we're going to dig into that a little bit with Heidi Stevens, and then our Family Matters segment, and then our Trending Topics segment, including that petition to change the Super Bowl to Saturday. It's building. People love this idea. Roger Goodell does not. We're going to talk about that coming up here on the show. Anna D here in the Skyline studio talking about State Street, that great street. We were mentioning it earlier in the show about how there's a plan to do a major overhaul of State Street. What would it look like? What would you do? Would you do anything to it? In this world where shopping malls and retail, they're all trying to reinvent themselves in order to compete with the online shopping world, State Street has found itself in a position where they want to sort of say, hey, the retail merchants and the Chicago Loop Alliance, they're all trying to figure out, what does it look like for the future? So the director of the Chicago Loop Alliance that's putting together a plan moving forward for State Street, and we'll have some options for people to weigh in on what you think should be done. Kalindi Parikh is here with us. Hey, Kalindi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I read about this and I thought, well, you know, gee, I guess it makes sense that you, each store individually right now, you think of retailers, whether they're chains or mom and pops, they're all kind of going through this idea of what do I look like and how do I compete with this online shopping world? And I feel like this is interesting that you took the whole of State Street and you said, let's have at it. Let's take a look at what we need to do for the future. What do you have in mind here?
Well, I think it's not a secret that, you know, downtowns in general are changing. You know, typically in the past when State Street was maybe, you know, named that great street, it was that, you know, destination for suburban shoppers to come downtown. I know the phrase typically drop off grandma, you know, and have a whole day of a shopping experience, right? But the way that people consume goods is changing, right? People might go downtown to look at something, try something out, and then eventually order it online. So right now what we're thinking about is how do we use those footprints that have been built in those great historic buildings and utilize them in a way that's still going to be active and create a really interesting street while, you know, making sure that, you know, everything is still vibrant and exciting and that those footprints are remaining filled and not vacant.
So State Street went through a major overhaul. I guess it was 1995. There was a big plan to do something then, and they didn't necessarily get everything right back then, did they, Kalindi?
So actually, the plan that didn't get everything right
was the one before that?
Before, yeah. So that was in the 70s.
Oh, so 95 was to correct some of the plans from before.
Absolutely, yeah. So the plan in the 70s was to shut down State Street to traffic, create a pedestrian and bus mall, really to mimic some of those suburban shopping centers downtown. And it really hurt a lot of the retail. The street really changed. It became very vacant and cavernous. There was a lot of pollution and crime. And so the last plan that we did was the 1987 plan that eventually opened up in 96.
So you opened up the street again then.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sidewalks they weren't huge sidewalks in this place,
right,
that was shut off from traffic.
Right. We reopened the street to traffic at that point. And that's what the street looks like now, was from that plan. Mm-hmm. So it includes all of the, you know, historic looking bus shelters and And, you know, the benches and the light poles and the color of the pavement, all of those were from that plan back in the 90s. And so now we're looking at, you know, past 2020.
Got it. Yeah. Well, the history of State Street is like a history of retail when you think about the stores that have moved in and out of there. The Goldblatt's closed in 1981. I remember the Goldblatt's. Montgomery Ward's flagship store there shuttered in 84. The Sears store in 86. Weebolts. I remember Weebolts. It went dark in 87. And you think about that, how some of these brands, you know, have struggled over the years or even not survived at all. But what do you do in retail, in the retail world? Because it is a retail street. Do you change that piece of it? Is that something you're even looking at?
Actually, yeah. I mean, downtowns across the board now are kind of reevaluating how much retail do we really need, and are the footprints that we have are the appropriate size for retail? You know, do we need, you know, we're noticing Macy's is actually downsizing the portion of their building that's going to be a store, and they're adding in other uses on top. You know, are there opportunities for us now to reimagine downtown as more of a neighborhood where there's residential and schools and things other than shopping? And I think that really is going to be what, you know, gets us out of, you know, that potential vacancy. I think that we really need to be forward thinking and think about downtown as one of Chicago's many neighborhoods.
So residential, you move more of that closer in. Would that be on top of stores, or would that be actually on State Street itself, do you think? Or what would that look like?
Sure. I mean, we have, you know, actually a big growing residential population in the Loop right now. Our most recent economic profile that we released last year actually showed that there are now 30,000 people living in the Loop. Back the last time we did this plan, I think there was about 40 people living on State Street.
How long ago was that?
That was
Kalindi.
Probably the 87 plan was okay. Probably there was almost nobody here.
So major growth.
Major growth. And what we are seeing is a lot of that mixed use development, right? So you see, you know, some great shopping downstairs and then residences upstairs and even some really interesting uses like the Joffrey residences right on State Street that have residential and also a ballet school.
Yes. My daughter went to that ballet school for a couple of years. It's really well attended. Yeah. That's why it's interesting to see how much really is going on there. It isn't purely right now a retail street, though in our minds, I think we think of it that way. Right. You think of at holiday time going to see the windows still. I did that this year. Many people do that. That's still in place. Do you see any of that going away?
You know, we hope that we keep some of that historical legacy. You know, I think that there is a lot of nostalgia that comes with State Street. And a lot of that is just that we have these historic, incredible buildings and architecture and also people's experiences from when they were a kid and they used to come downtown. So I think that there is a way to incorporate that while still being forward thinking and incorporating some more uses.
312, one thing that would greatly help Macy's, the more people who really can just serve a customer. I couldn't find anyone on the third floor yesterday, so I walked out. I think there's sort of a struggle in retail because of the costs of having a bricks and mortar store and they're competing and that kind of thing. You see this and you see a lot of stores trying this experiential route. Mm-hmm. You see the Starbucks I mentioned earlier on Mag Mile, the world's largest Starbucks. That's supposed to be an entire experience. You go in there and you see how the coffee beans turn in, you know, how everything happens, how mm-hmm. the whole product is made, and you can buy, you know, you can sniff different coffee beans from all around the world and, you know, taste their chocolate and their sandwiches and their Princi bar up there with the breads. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes sort of a destination.
Sure.
Do you advise any retailers about kind of the plans about what might reinvigorate their businesses along the street? Is that even part of what you guys do?
It might be part of this plan. I think it's not something that we've done in the past. Things that we have done in the past related to retail is activating vacant retail spaces, and encouraging people to, you know, keep their window spaces active. But I think in the future, that could be a really interesting outcome of this plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're hearing a lot about experiential retail, and it seems to be a really good, you know, way to get people in the door, right? You even see, I think it's that AT&T store where you go in and there's the Game of Thrones chair and people want to come take their picture. I think a lot of it is about that Instagrammable moment. And State Street is super Instagrammable. You know, you get to take your picture with the Chicago Theater sign and all of the really great iconic buildings. But how do we bring that, you know, past the front door? I think that that's another big question. How do we get people, you know, excited about what is inside the buildings on State Street?
How about, here's 847, how about affordable middle class senior living, or maybe just middle class living in general, affiliated with DePaul or Roosevelt? I'm a retired lecturer or teacher, it sounds like, and we're looking for affordable housing downtown. I know affordable housing is a big discussion at City Hall right now, and this mayor that's on her radar to try to figure that out. Could it ever be affordable to live downtown?
I sure hope so. Yeah, I really think that, you know, whenever we're thinking about a very full and complete neighborhood, it's not complete without affordable housing, right? And so where does that fit into the picture of State Street? You know, you do look at a lot of the residences in the Loop, and now you're seeing a lot of luxury residential or those very small footprints for students. You know, so where does that fit into that picture? I think that's a big part of why we're studying this. And mm-hmm. but also understanding that, you know, is there demand for that? It seems like, you know, it seems like there is.
Yeah, it does seem like there are a number of people stepping forward to figure this out for the city. So you don't have to live so far out. You can be right. part of the vibrancy of the city and still afford to live there. You know, you've seen other cities like San Francisco that and New York, I would say, who kind of have shut out people who are middle income and even right. above, because it just becomes so unaffordable right. to truly live there. So that's a separate issue, though. But one thing I want to ask you about is Michigan Avenue, Mag Mile. Mm-hmm. I've seen some pop-up stores there, and these stores that just show up for Christmas time or sure. just for a few months, and it's just like a brand sampling thing, or mm-hmm. there's a Halloween type thing. And I just wonder, how do you feel about pop-up stores? I never imagined that would happen on Michigan Avenue. It seems for so long it was this upscale shopping destination, and I don't think it hurts it really. Sometimes I like these pop-up stores. I just wonder what the feeling is about that kind of store.
Yeah, I think we're really excited about pop-up retail. I think for us the challenge is figuring out where is the right footprint, right? The city recently updated their pop-up retail legislation, and they made it a lot easier to do pop-up retail, which is great. The hard part is finding both, you know, the property owner that's willing to do that. Typically it might be a cheaper lease for a short period of time, or, you know, some sort of other deal that gets worked out. But a lot of times what we see, too, is that pop-up retail does result in a longer-term brick and mortar, or that, you know, a business from maybe out in the neighborhood that finally gets, you know, a chance to be downtown and to have a platform downtown gets to strengthen their business. And so we're actually looking at doing that on Wabash. That's one of our other initiatives. So we might be trying to figure out how to do that this year.
Isn't there some sort of Wabash Lights program that's also in the works over there, so that they have these beautiful lights underneath the L-tracks?
Yeah, that's a different group. It's called the Wabash Lights. They're a great group, and their big focus is on, you know, putting up these interactive lights, but also they do a lot with STEM education, sorry, with the arts.
STEAM, what's the A?
Arts.
Arts.
Yeah, so they're a great organization, so check them out, too.
Science, technology, engineering, arts, and math.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, so what can people do if they want to contribute, if someone has an idea about what they'd like to see on State Street? What's happening moving forward, Kalindi?
We're very excited for you to come out and join us. So we will have a series of public meetings over the course of the spring. You can sign up for more updates on loopchicago.com/statestreet. Sign up for our email list and you'll be updated about those meetings. We also have an upcoming annual meeting. That's just our yearly meeting that's for our stakeholders and other people in the city who are interested in what the Loop Alliance is generally doing. That's going to be on February 20th, and you can find out more information about that on loopchicago.com/annual meeting. And we're actually going to have our keynote speaker for that is our consultant for the State Street plan. So he's going to give us a little bit of, you know, background on, you know, what is the plan and what is the process like? So for people who are interested, they can come get tickets and hear Ernie Wong speak.
How long do you think it'll be before we see this transformation of State Street at least start?
Great question. So the plan itself will be released in fall of 2020. So that's when we'll have the document that's sort of the guiding document of, here are the projects that the community has identified that we want to do, and here's a little bit about how to get them done. Plans, I think especially good plans, have multiple kinds of recommendations. Some of them are those low-hanging fruit, things that we can accomplish within a year or 2 years, 5 years. And then there are some of those longer-term projects that might be advocacy projects or require partnerships or external funding. And those might be, you know, a bit longer out. But we're hoping to get started right in 2021.
All right. So it's heading your way. If you want to contribute, you want to be part of the vision for the new State Street and what happens in that district, loopchicago.com/State Street is a place to go. loopchicago.com. Kalindi Parikh, the Director of the Chicago Loop Alliance, thank you for sharing what you know right now, and keep us posted on the plans for the future.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, this one of the stars from NBC's Chicago Fire will be on the show to talk about a great fundraiser for our first responders here in the Chicago area. This is Anna DeVlantis in the Skyline Studio. Coming up on Trending Topics later in the show, we will talk about those iPass records and the plan to try to crack down on who can get them. Should it be allowed in a criminal case? Should law enforcement be allowed to get them? I think there are a number of cases where that seems perfectly reasonable, but should it be allowed in civil cases as well, divorce cases, anyone who files a court case against you? and has subpoena power. Should they be allowed to get your IPASS records? There is a discussion about that, and we're going to continue that conversation later in the show. But right now, one of the stars of NBC's Chicago Fire is here, David Eigenberg. You know him as the lieutenant. It's my favorite. You're my favorite character on Chicago Fire because you're the guy who reminds me of the Chicago firefighters who you actually meet. You're not the blow-dried version or whatever. And I love all the guys. I do. But you are one of the ones that just like, oh my gosh, you got this kind of gritty, raw, tell it like it is sort of approach to the whole thing. And I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been in Chicago for a long time. When I first got here, I immediately started cluing in on the men and the women and how do they get through and how do they do what they do. And you kind of, I mean, Chicago's a unique city because it's a great city and there are great people here, but there's some salty characters, and I just kind of went, yeah, I'm going to go salty. I'm a little salty myself, but I wanted to go that route with this character, and I got lucky, you know. And now my wife just was going to make up a T-shirt because we've been here quite a while now, and she's going to make a T-shirt. Says I was young when I got here, and I'm aging rapidly on this show, but that just means it's been
a successful show. You guys have been on for how many seasons now?
We're halfway through our eighth season. Yeah,
so cool. So, you also get as part of the, you just referenced it, but as part of the job is you guys do interact with real first responders in the city. I see them as extras on the set because I know you shoot my neighborhood a lot in the West Loop, and I see you guys. But it's also, you know, you're interacting with them more often than I would think if you're just watching the show. I didn't know there was that kind of interaction, but you do get to know them.
Oh yeah, we spend a lot of time with the real firefighters. Some of them are retired. Some of them are inactive. You know, they're active firefighters on their day off, working with us. And you know, they drive all of our rigs, and they're there, and they're fire safety officers. And we have a lot of stuff going on, and you know, and we've gotten to know quite a few. And you know, it's, you know, I'm just to intro myself into, you know, talking today about this great event that's going on Sunday with the 100 Club of Chicago, which provides support for in the line of death, in the line of duty deaths that occur sometimes, unfortunately, with our first responders. And you know, over the years, the first season I was here, I saw one of the firefighters I'd gotten to know a little bit, and I saw him standing over in a corner by himself, and I immediately went, something's not right. And I went over to a fella, and I said, are you okay? And he said, we just lost one of our guys. And I didn't know at the time, but it was a great firefighter who I never got to meet, was friends with all the guys who work with Herbie Johnson. And he went down the line of duty in 2012. And over the years, I've gotten to know his family. And some of us, you know, we went to his funeral just out of respect and quietly in the back, which is what we've done over the years. But all that said and done, you know, the 100 Club has done such a great job of making sure that these families, when the tragedy falls upon them, that they get immediate assistance with anything that they need. And granted, you know, the firefighters take care of their own, and everybody in the police take care of their own. They're all on top of it. But they go, here's money. So you don't even think about it. We got this. We'll get that. We'll get this. And then down the road, they look after their kids, and they make sure that these kids are recipients of the scholarships, you know, for the sacrifice that their parents have made for them. So I'm kind of waxing on here
you've done a lot of work with them, David, and I can tell you've become very close not only to the cause but to the people behind this cause. And I know Joe Ahern, who runs the 100 Club of Chicago, he tells us all the time, when an officer dies in the line of duty, their organization shows up with a $50,000 check, and then they start working with the family from there to say, hey, how can we help you? What are the needs right now with your family? And on top of that, they have 31 kids in college. They're putting through college right now, so they provide for their college education. He says, sadly, there are 87 more kids coming through their pipeline in the next 18 years that they will be paying college for. We've had nine line of duty deaths in the last 2 years, so think about that. Nine lives lost in our area. Nine. It's just It's,
yeah, yeah. I've met Commander Bauer's family. He has the little kids and also Juan Bucio, the firefighter that died, I forget the exact date, about a year and a half ago. And they all have, you know, these wonderful, you know, young children in their lives, and they're going to grow up. And Hunter Club just does such an outstanding job of, you know, of reaching out and taking care of these families, because they deserve above and beyond treatment. And it is just great at providing that for them. So this we're doing this thing at Spin, and we're going to be playing. I'm going to be playing some of the Herbie Johnson's family, the Johnson family, and there. Herbie Johnson was anyone will tell you was a real character. He was a real firecracker. I never met the gentleman, but everything I've ever heard about him and his family, I heard is not quite as lively as he was, but they are definitely very lively. So they're going to be playing us in ping pong on Sunday from 3 to 5 over at this facility. I just forgot the name of it, but
we'll get it. Hang on.
Yeah. But it's going to be a great day. You know, and also people should also know, they might be listening in, that they can become a member of the Hunter Club by just making a small donation, which, you know, I do every year. And because they're just great people, and just giving a little bit, you know, goes so far with because they're a highly, highly rated charity. There's no nonsense of the, you know, of the stuff that happens sometimes with other silly charities that don't stick to their mission and start, you know, doing other stuff with money. But the Hunter Club is just a great, great organization.
They have a great reputation, I should say. And do hear from the family members all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just, it becomes a community. And, you know, sadly, those families then become very close because of what's happened to them. And I know that's helpful. And I've been to a number of their events myself. And it's just, I'm thankful that the Hunter Club exists. And I think it's a worthy cause to support. And we're going to get all the information about the Spin Chicago. So how does it go?
Thank
it's a cast that plays who? Who do you guys play? Because
last year was just cast versus cast, and Chicago Fire trounced the other ones. They were all, you know, they all were pretty, and they got the nice hair, and they got the pretty noses, but we just trounced them. And, you know, I'm kind of busted up, and Eamon Walker, who plays the chief, he's, take a good look at him, he's a little busted up, too. He kind of came from the streets of London, and we just trounced him. So this year, they were like, well, we got to spice it up. So they just said they were going to bring in the real heroes, the real first responders, the real police officers, and some EMS folks, and also the firefighters are going to be coming in. And we probably will get our bottoms handed to us in a basket, but it's all for a good cause, and I'll go down fighting, but I'll go down happy. So it's okay.
And there'll be some smack talking. It certainly sounds like it's Sunday.
Absolutely.
It's,
oh no. Yeah. Something inappropriate will be said at some point. I hope it doesn't get out, because when we get going, we actors have kind of a similar sense of humor to our first responders. We don't go through the same things, but we laugh just as hard. That's for sure. That's, you know, we really get along because we laugh really hard when we're with the first responders. We go, okay, you want to go? Let's go. So we have a good time.
It does sound like that. So here's the deal. It's Sunday at Spin, 344 North State. Tickets just $30 or $35 at the door. So you buy in advance, you get a little break there, and then it includes ping pong, snacks, and a beer. Hey. What a deal.
There you go.
What a deal. Yep. So you, Jesse Spencer of Chicago Fire, you got some Chicago Med people coming out, Chicago PD coming out. So, it's going to be a fun event.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
David Eigenberg, thank you so much for calling in and
thank you.
Telling us all about it. Have fun out
there. Absolutely. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. You too. What is coming up next here on WGN Radio? What's happening over at the Chicago Tribune? Some of the people, the reporters there, are posting on social media how they're bracing for their colleagues marching out, holding their cardboard boxes in their arms as they've been given buyout letters. The buyout letters are out. What's next for the Chicago Tribune? Heidi Stevens, Chicago Tribune columnist, here to tell us more about it. Back here in the Skyline Studios, it's me, Anna D., Anna DeVlantis. We were just talking with actor David Eigenberg, smack-talking, gritty, tell-it-like-it-is fire department lieutenant, the character he plays, and he seems a lot like that in person, too, I might add. But he was promoting a cool event he's doing this weekend in Chicago. Again, it's at Spin Chicago. And it's $30, 3 p.m. on Sunday. Just $30 if you buy it in advance. It's $30. If you buy it at the door, it is $35. But it's a really cool event at Spin Downtown. So check that out. It'll be it's a great cause, 100 Club of Chicago. Go to their website and you can find out more as well. Here's something else coming up soon here. A lot of us here at WGN Radio will be out there. I'm not personally climbing, but I tend to go out there and cheer on everybody from the station. I don't know if Lauren or Steve, are you guys participating in the American Lung Association Fight for Air Climb?
We talked about this before, yeah. And I said, as long as there's someone dedicated to carry me when I can't breathe after like one flight, I'm totally down.
You could use some real firefighters out there, yeah. I think. Yeah. How about you, Steve?
I will be pulling for you. I will be supporting you from home.
How do you support from home?
Well, I really wish hard that you do well. No, I'm not going to participate.
Steve, okay. Maybe you could just post something on social media.
Okay,
that would be a nice thing.
I could do that.
It's something that's a little bit easier to do from home. Hey, go team, something like that. That might help. Dave Ennett's always doing it. He's leading it. He's like the first guy up and down and up and down, because I think there are four different towers to check out. You don't have to do all four either. That's the cool part. Join WGN Radio and WGN TV at the biggest air climb in Chicago. It's the Fight for Air Climb presented by United Healthcare. At Presidential Towers, Sunday, March 8th, your first step is to register or donate at WGNRadio.com/events or fightforairclimb.org. That's the place to go, fightforairclimb.org. You can climb 1, 2, 3, or all four towers, 2,340 steps in total. Every step counts in our fight for clean air and healthy lungs. The American Lung Association, Fight for Air Climb, March 8th. Register, pledge your support. WGNRadio.com/events or fightforairclimb.com. All right. Heidi Stevens, Tribune columnist, has just stepped into the studio. Hey, Heidi.
Hi.
Normally, you're here talking about family issues. We discuss so many things about parenting and things like that. But today, it's about your colleagues at the Tribune making news. And for not a great reason. I saw a bunch of people posting, people I know and as reporters in town, posting on social media about, hey, I've just been given a buyout letter. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Is a lot going on over there. Let us know what's going on.
Yeah, so we got an email from our CEO last week that buyouts were coming. And then yesterday was when the email arrived with the actual offer and the details and the deadline and all of that. So that's what you were seeing happening on Twitter and maybe Facebook too. There's... an effort, I guess, to get the staff down to a little bit smaller size as we possibly transition into Alden taking a larger stake in the company.
So give folks an idea. Alden is a hedge fund that took about a third stake in Tribune Publishing recently. They're a hedge fund that has taken over other publications, other sort of newsrooms, and have been known for really gutting newsrooms. I remember seeing the picture of the Denver Post when they took a picture of their staff, everybody's kind of sitting together in the newsroom before Alden took a stake in their publication, and then after they X'd out the faces of the people who are no longer there, and it was really less than half.
It was stark. Yeah, right. Was that silhouette sort of photo?
Yes.
It was really powerful, wasn't it?
It told the story of how will you cover Denver and smaller city than Chicago with that staff and do the job they've come to be known to do, because they, like the Tribune, have won all the awards, have done this amazing work, have exposed corruption, have talked about abuse of children, have brought to the forefront so many meaningful, important issues over the years. That how do you do it with less is always the question.
That's right. That's right. And so, the background, you covered it perfectly. But the Michael Farrow sold all of his shares, right, in Tribune Publishing, and then he sold them to Alden. And so now they have a 32% stake in the company. And, there's talk that they will acquire an even larger stake in 2020. And so possibly this buyout is, in a way, paring the staff down in advance of that. And that's the real, I guess, overwhelming feeling in the newsroom right now is just sadness for, certainly ourselves and our colleagues, but mostly for the city and the idea of sort of this institutional knowledge and wisdom walking out the door and no longer being the eyes and ears and voice of Chicago. And certainly Chicago is lucky to have a fantastic group of journalists at the Sun-Times and Black Club and The Tribe and BZ and GN. Absolutely. And, you know, we are not the only people in town doing this work. But, you know, this is also a time in our city, in our state, in our country, in our world, really, where we need all the eyes and ears we can get. And so, you know, decimating any publication that, you know, keeps people informed as they go to the polls and as they try to decide where to send their kids to school and who to trust with their charitable giving and what their tax dollars are doing. You know, that's a loss when you don't have extra oversight on those things and guidance on those things.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I wonder, do we know how many cuts there will be, because the Tribune's gone through some cuts recently. This isn't the first round.
Not the first round, no. I've been there since 98, and I feel like this is the fourth or fifth buyout offer, you know, in the time that I've been there. And usually they're followed by layoffs if they don't get to the number they need to get to from buyouts. We don't know. We, you know, we're the guild, the union, is negotiating with the company on the terms of the buyouts and also still on the terms of a contract. And some of the questions they're asking are, you know, include what's the dollar you're trying to get to? And we just don't know that. So, you know, a lot of people are talking. Are you taking it? Or are you not taking it? Mm-hmm. I mean, people are doing the calculations. So that kind of buzz is certainly happening. But I think the larger thing on everybody's minds is just, what does this mean for Chicago and the Midwest and the nation as a whole when newspapers are cut to the bone?
Mm-hmm. What did happen in other papers? Have you followed this kind of thing, Heidi? Because you've seen this in other places across the country where this has happened.
Yeah.
And there were concerns about, will we be able to hold our political leaders accountable? Will we truly be able to be a watchdog? Will we be able to be a voice for the community and do the things that you come to expect from a great journalism kind of paper like the Chicago Tribune?
Yeah. You brought up the Denver Post, which is one of the most stark examples. The same thing happened in San Jose and also Boston, not the Boston Globe, but the Boston Herald. And often what happens is sometimes most feature staffs are sort of either eliminated or cut. Sometimes just news and sports are emphasized. News and sports are obviously hugely important beats, but I would argue all of our beats are hugely important.
Yeah.
And the staffs get cut sometimes by, you know, a half or a third.
Mm-hmm. So anybody with 8 or more years mm-hmm. has been offered one of these buyout letters. That seems to be mm-hmm. probably a great number of people.
Yeah.
So they're just sort of giving a number of people in the newsroom this option.
Yes.
With the idea that some people will voluntarily take it, and that will meet enough of the cost-cutting measures.
I think that's the hope. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it will?
I don't know, because I don't know what the dollar figure is that they're trying to get to, and I don't know how many people will take it. I don't know anyone who has his or her mind made up and paperwork signed. I know a lot of people who are making the calculations. How quickly can I line up the next thing? Is there a next thing for me? How long can I afford to not have a next thing? So everybody, you know, not everybody, I don't want to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Many people are making those calculations right now, but I don't know how many, and I don't know in the end who's going to submit and who's not going to. You know, I hope, just for the sake of my colleagues, and like I said, for the sake of the city, that nobody is involuntarily, you
cut.
Know, cut. Exactly.
Although our digital successes, this is from Tim Knight, President and CEO of Tribune Publishing. Although our digital successes provide good momentum, we continue to face industry-wide revenue challenges. It's no secret the newspaper industry is facing those types of challenges, and that there's been this movement online, but the ad dollars don't always follow to the same degree.
Mm-hmm.
The future here, I guess, is in question about the models and how you make it work, and obviously what kind of parent is the right parent company for something that's really more about the community and journalism and isn't necessarily just strictly a for-profit business model.
That's right. Yeah. And we're seeing examples, you know, at the LA Times and in the Washington Post where buyers come in and they have their own money. Not necessarily.
Jeff Bezos has a little money.
He's got a little spare change.
Extra.
Yeah. And there's less pressure then, right, on those newsrooms to turn a profit. And they have a little cushion to make that transition from print to digital and to get more digital subscribers and to get digital to start making money. I think we're seeing interesting examples around Chicago, too, of other ways to, you know, stay alive. And the Reader just became a, you know, nonprofit, right? And mm-hmm. I like Black Club Chicago's example, model, I should say, where it's more of a, almost like a membership, the way NPR does. You know, you decide, you know, to pay your monthly subscription, and that keeps it free for everyone who wants to use it. I think, mm-hmm. you know, we're in a time where, you know, journalism needs to reinvent itself a bit in terms of the business model. And I really hope that the Tribune gets the time and resources and bandwidth to do that, because it's not an overnight thing. It's not even an over a year thing. It's a big, important transition.
Yeah, it is. Heidi Stevens, thank you for coming and telling us more about it, and keep us posted. And my best to you and all of your colleagues at the Chicago Tribune. And we'll be following it, and then hopefully see you back here for one of our Family Matters segments.
Of course.
I love hearing your viewpoints on all things, but this one, I'm glad you came in for. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom, and then our Family Matters segment, how to spot winter blues in yourself or a family member, how to know when it's a little more than that, seasonal affective disorder or more than that. Plus, Meghan Markle is getting mommy shamed for how she held her baby. Is that okay? We're going to have more coming up after the news here on WGN. It's Thursday here on WGN. It's Thursday everywhere, but we're talking Family Matters because it's Thursday. Here in studio with me, Rachel Cazes. She is a licensed clinical social worker. She founded All Along, a great organization. We want to talk more about at some point here to help people deal with mental health and get help when they need it. She has more to tell us about that. Also with us, Florence Ann Romano. She's the Windy City Nanny. WindyCityNanny.com. She's a longtime nanny turned TV host and advisor on children's issues on the Leadership Council with Sesame Street. How about that? That's got to be a fun job. Florence, you enjoy doing that?
Oh my gosh, who doesn't love Sesame Street, right? It's just the most natural thing in the world for to become a child and adult, and it just stays with you.
Well, then there's also, they tackle such serious issues, and you think about it over the years, everything from divorce to addiction to, you know, Sesame Street handles it in a way that really only Sesame Street can, I think, in terms of making it approachable, even for the littlest of little kids.
So well said. My brother has autism, only 17 months younger than I am, and Sesame Street's really how he learned when he was younger. And now to see Sesame Street have a Muppet that has autism and a family that talks about having a child with autism and typical siblings, it's wonderful to see what Sesame Street tackles from that point of view. But then there's a new Foster, you know, Muppet on Sesame Street.
Carly, are you talking about Carly?
Yes.
The one who has the addicted parent, so she has to stay away from her parent for a little while, and while mom gets better and
Works
through it.
And they have a beautiful way of creating that narrative for children where it's accessible and not scary, and they still feel safe, but that they can start conversations. It's awesome. I'm really, really proud to be on the Leadership Council.
Yeah, I bet. That sounds like a really meaningful thing to be part of. Rachel, I know you are part of All Along. You founded this organization here in Chicago. And what is that about?
With All Along, I help people find mental health.
We got you back on. I apologize.
Okay.
Now we hear you.
Cool. I founded All Along in 2016. I help people across the country understand mental health better and find the right therapy. So that sometimes means that I'm here talking with people like you guys, which is great. And often it means that I am doing individualized consultations with people across the country to help them navigate the mental health system where they are.
Okay. So you feel like a lot of people don't necessarily turn to mental health help right away. There's sort of a little bit of reluctance to do that, would you say?
I think it depends on the person. But the idea with All Along is that most people don't get to talk to a therapist until they're actually sitting in a therapy room with a therapist who they've chosen and are beginning treatment with. And I think it's, I work as a therapist, and when I tell people that, they often have comments and questions, and I think it's cool to get to interact with people outside the walls of a therapy office.
Sure.
And answer their questions so that when somebody starts to think, you know, I think I might need some treatment, it's helpful to have somebody who's an expert in the field to walk you through it.
Yeah, I bet. I bet you do a lot of real good there. When did you found that whole organization, All Along?
In 2016.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's get to some of the ideas and the topics here we want to discuss. Winter blues is top of the list because I think this time of year, you've got sort of the haze. You don't see the sun as much. People are less likely to get out and be social. When it's cold, that just does happen. Even if you're the most ambitious of persons, that happens. And I feel like there are several levels of this. So some people have that sort of, God, I'm just sort of just feeling groggy today and I'm just got the winter blues. Then there's that seasonal affective disorder you hear about. And then there's that level beyond that. And I guess, Rachel, I'd ask you, how would you determine where you might fall and how you know if it's something you kind of got to pay attention to, whether it's you or a family member?
Mm-hmm. So I would start by just trying to see what the variable is that's changing, that might be making this happen. So is it just that, like today, it's kind of slushy outside and you usually take a run, but it didn't feel possible and you're a little bummed that you couldn't be as active? Or is it that the amount of light is much lower and that you're somebody who's sensitive to the amount of light, and that can make you feel more tired, or that can make you really change your mood on a biochemical level? Or is there something else that's changing about your social activities or exercise or schedule or something like that? And so I think you're asking, how would I tell the difference between?
Yeah, how would you tell when you're sort of moving down that line where it's getting to a point where you might need some help or you might need to do something?
Yeah, I think my answer to that usually is if you are experiencing something and you're like, man, this is really unpleasant and I think I might want some help, just go for it. The first session with a therapist is always to help you figure out what's going on and what might be helpful. So you don't have to figure that out by yourself. I would also say, though, if that's not as appealing to you, but you want to do something else to figure out what's going on or to help yourself feel better, try to be social, try to be active, make sure that you're eating fruits and vegetables, make sure you're awake and outside during the daylight, even if it is cloudy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hear a lot of people complaining about the weather. I mean, we live in Chicago, we deal with it, we're hardy people. If you've lived here any period of time, you can deal with any kind of weather. That's who we are as a people. I get that. But I feel like sometimes you hear things from friends or family and it sounds a little worse than that. Like, you know, I just don't feel like going out in this anymore. Or there's something that sort of rises to that mm-hmm. different level.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we should pay attention to that, you know, and ask them about it.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. Kind of the tone of your voice shifts, you know, in the way that you were saying it, just like, I don't want to do this anymore. And so I think that's something where sometimes people assume that depression means just feeling sad a lot, when in fact, it often looks more like feeling numb or hopeless or something else like that. So that would definitely be signs to watch out for.
Yeah, that is, I hear it all the time. And then every once in a while, it gets a little more alarming. And I think, wait a minute, I should listen to that and mm-hmm. hear that person and talk to them about it. So important stuff to think about. Let's talk about this too. Kids and the news, how to know when and how much to tell them. This comes up a lot. I mean, it's coming up potentially in a lot of homes right now with impeachment going on. And I guess I'm sometimes jealous of the news-free bubble that little kids get to live in. But once they get to be 6, 7, 8 years old, they start asking the real questions about, you know, what is impeachment and what's happening and why is everybody fighting with each other on TV or whatever the question is. My daughter just turned 8 and she's asking these questions. And you wonder, like, how do you sort of approach that as a parent, and how do you know when to engage them in the news, Florence? I mean, you've been a nanny for how many years? You've dealt with every kid and their constant questions.
Every kid, so many questions. And sometimes you just ask them a question instead, and then all of a sudden they forgot about the question they asked you.
That's a good strategy. That's a great strategy.
Right? So ask them.
Look over there.
And how about that? But no, you bring up a good point about your daughter being 8. And I think that's actually a really good age to start broaching those topics that, you know, about what's going on with social events and, you know, government, things like that. A really big part of being a parent or being a caretaker in any way is being an educator in some sort of form. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to tell them the whole truth. You can give them little cliff note versions of what it is and, you know, start to educate them about maybe the way our government behaves and what does the government look like and what's their job. So it's not necessarily answering the exact question, but it's about giving them the background about what their question really encompasses.
What's an example of that for us?
So what would you say? Impeachment. I would suggest telling a child, you know, how our kind of government system works when it comes to the president of the United States and what is the president's job, and then start to put that into terms for them to understand. You know, if perhaps you're on the school board, if you're the parent on a school board, you can say, you know, it's like how mom or dad, you know, is on the board at your school and we make decisions for people and, you know, we talk about what's the best thing for you and the school and your classmates. You can put it into that context for them so they can start to be able to relate to it in a way that makes sense to them. You don't need to start telling them about balance of power and this and that. They can learn that in school. They'll be, you know, bored enough when that comes up.
Now, that's Adam Schiff. That's Nancy Pelosi. That's the president. I mean, oh, my gosh. Right. Forget about it.
Too much. So remember that, you know, see it through a child's eyes.
Yes, that's a great, great, great advice. Florence Ann Romano is the Windy City Nanny. And Rachel Cazes is a licensed clinical social worker, founder of All Along, helping you understand mental health and find care when you need it. We're back with our guests and more. One of the topics we have to tackle is spying on your kids. Lots of ways to do it. When is it appropriate? How much is appropriate? Good questions. We'll ask them coming up. All right, Family Matters Thursday continues with our guests here in studio. We have Florence Ann Romano. She's the Windy City Nanny. Find her at windycitynanny.com. Longtime nanny turned TV host, also an advisor on children's issues. Rachel Cazes is a licensed clinical social worker and the founder of All Along. Check it out at allalong.org, helping you understand mental health and finding care when you need it. All right, this is a great topic for our times. It's about spying on your kids. I mean, so many ways to do it. I know so many parents in my world have those phone apps where they track activity and they track how many hours or minutes you're on your phone. And those seem like reasonable things to do. They seem like helpful things to do to know what your kid's doing, where they're surfing, who they may be meeting up with online. But then you've got like this whole idea of placing cameras in their room and cameras, you know, wherever you want. I mean, picking up on what they're doing at any given moment. And I guess, Florence, I'd ask you, you've dealt with so many children over the years. What do you think what's your idea about what's right to do there and when it doesn't start to feel right to you?
Well, first and foremost, I am an advocate of the nanny cam. I get a little flack from this as a, you know, former nanny that I would say that, but I want people to challenge this in a specific way. I mentioned I have a brother with autism and my brother doesn't have a whole lot of language. What do you do for children that can't be advocates for themselves? How do you trust but verify? A nanny cam is a great way to do that. Even a newborn baby can't talk for themselves. How do you know if there's abuse there? We see it on the news all the time. Children with special needs, you know, a nanny sitting on top of them because they're having a tantrum and they can't handle it. Or a baby is, you know, unable to be soothed and they get frustrated as the nanny and they scream at the baby. I mean, this stuff really happens and it's scary, but it's true. And I rather families take the next step, have a nanny cam, be able to see what's going on, to corroborate the story. And it's not just to protect the children, not just to protect the parents, but also to protect the nanny too. If something happens in that home that was a freak accident, they can't sit there and say you were negligent. So a nanny cam can be very beneficial. But just like anything in life, people always take it to that other level where they make it naughty. They make, you know, all that stuff happens. And then you're like, come on, you really had to do that. But people do that.
Meaning taking a look at your nanny changing,
yes,
and things like that.
Because
there was a story about that. I think it was out of New York,
yes,
or something.
That just came out. And then he tried to backtrack. He's like, no, I like to watch myself undress, not watch the press. I'm like, okay, that
so
feels
it was about
weird.
Watching himself, not
right.
The nanny?
Yes, that's what he was saying. Hmm. And so, I mean, it's the strangest story. But, I mean, there are rules. There are legal realities attached to the nanny cams. Like in Illinois, for example, it's completely legal for you to have a nanny cam and to have that footage without the nanny consenting to it.
Really?
But audio is something you have to get consent for in Illinois. It's different in every state. But I mean, just really honestly, be sensible about it, about how you're going to place these nanny cams and what you're using them for. There's so much technology available to us today. for nanny cams and what they're there to do. But remember the real reason why you have them. And that's to give you peace of mind so you can leave the home and trust the person that's watching your child. And it's a decision you have to make based on the values of your family and your own personal values, whether or not that's a technology that you believe in and you want to employ.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess if you put it one in the living room or you put one in the bedroom or where the nanny would go necessarily, that seems okay. I think the bathroom doesn't seem like a place where you'd want to put a nanny cam, but I guess everyone's allowed to. You're saying in Illinois, video's fine, audio's not fine.
In terms of consent, you can, in terms of using it in court, you don't have to get the nanny to sign off on just the video footage. But if you have it in the bathroom, for example, I understand why you'd want maybe a camera in the bathroom towards the tub if they're bathing your children to see if there's any abuse in that way. So you have to remember, it's not just trying to catch someone undressing or someone showering that you shouldn't. You're also trying to protect those children from abuse. Mm-hmm. And abuse can happen in the bathroom.
Yeah.
So where's that line?
Okay. Rachel, do you have thoughts about this whole thing? The idea of putting cameras in the house, watching your nanny, watching your kids?
I don't think I have comments about the nanny cam, but in terms of watching kids, I definitely work with a lot of teens and kids where the parents are wanting to track, the phone. And where, when I hear you talk about a camera like a nanny cam, but to watch the kid, that to me seems pretty unethical. And it also feels like I understand what you're saying, because a nanny is like someone that you're hiring. But mm-hmm. I think for your kid, there should be a relationship there where it's more trusting, where they have more freedom. And this is kind of related to what you were talking about with the questions that kids are asking as well. Kind of trusting that kids and teens are at their heart great, and that it's the people around them and the situations around them that might lead to problems. And so making sure that you're providing a situation and a relationship where you don't need to be monitoring them and tracking them all the time, but that you're instilling the values that you're looking for, you're instilling healthy habits, you're instilling a kid who is curious and motivated, as kids naturally are, and has a good sense for safety, which a lot of kids do.
So when people come to you in a clinical setting, they say, hey, I'm thinking about putting these cameras up and really spying on my teenagers in my house. You say, no, not a good idea. That's what your advice would be?
I would say don't put up cameras to spy on your teenagers.
Yep. Because you might be surprised, or just because it just breaks that trust barrier kind of thing.
I think that if you put in that level of external control, you are just asking for someone to rebel. Imagine if somebody wanted to watch you all the time.
Right. It would feel weird.
And said, I don't trust you no matter what you say. That's not a good way to build a relationship with your teen.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point. But as a nanny, you didn't seem to care when if they told you, hey, I'm going to be watching you. I've got cameras everywhere. So just know that.
When I was a nanny, nanny cams weren't really a thing. This has become, a bigger part of our society now. But honestly, my advice to anyone is you should be behaving as if someone's watching you. I mean, that's honestly the rule of thumb. So do the right thing. Yeah, just do the right thing.
You mentioned teenagers, Rachel. And I think that becomes an age group that becomes very frustrating for parents. You hear it all the time. It's tough because they feel like they're in a different world. They're interested in different things. Sometimes they want to do things their peers are doing, and that's part of growing up. And sometimes it can be super frustrating for a parent. But I think you take this very practical approach to it all, and you say meet them where they're at and try to create points where you can have discussions with them about the things they want to talk about. Kind of where it starts, don't you think?
Yeah.
What do you tell people, I guess, would be the better way to ask that kind of thing. When they come to you and they say, look, I'm just so frustrated. I have a teenager that's like, mm-hmm. Oh, my God, I'm pulling my hair out because I don't even understand what is going on here. The hormones, the decision making, the whatever they want to do, it's just wrong. It feels wrong. You hear
for
this
sure.
At that age.
Yeah.
Even though you in your mind, you might say that and you might not talk to your kid that way. But you go through a lot when you're dealing with teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I work with teenagers very much from the perspective that they are their own stage of life. They're not kids. They're not adults. And I think teenagers get a really bad reputation in media, which I guess we're on as well. But
we are, yes. But I think it's fair. You mean, look, I'm happy you're saying that because that's definitely true and they're not always seen in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Part of my goal with All Along is to spread more realistic or practical information about mental health and teenagers. That definitely is included in there as well. So what I would say is to, yeah, just kind of like I'm saying, like trust that at their core, they have a lot of fantastic qualities. And I think there's a reputation of being impulsive, poor decision making, things like that. And that's what we hear about. But we don't hear about the energy and creativity and intelligence and self-awareness. The kind of the developmental task of a teenager is to build a good sense of autonomy and to be able to balance the connection and stability with, of family with new independence and new interests and building the skills to be able to be an independent adult. And so I think when I work with teenagers and with families, I'm always trying to help them understand, okay, what worked 2 years ago probably isn't going to work anymore. Your teenager is great just how they are. How can we get out of their way and try to make it possible for them to thrive?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because you're right. The media, there are so many stories that sound scary that every parent might feel like, oh, what if my kid is vaping? What if my kid is doing drugs? What if my kid is doing all the bad things that I hear about, see in the media? And it just becomes a point where, well, they're not doing everything, right? They're not. Not every kid is doing all these bad things, but the worry becomes... It can help, it can create a bad relationship, I would think, with the kid. And it seems like, but if you do have a suspicion that a child is doing drugs or has an addiction of some sort, what do you recommend? How do you approach that?
I think the best thing to do is to start from the very beginning in forming a good, trusting relationship with your kid so that they can tell you about things and they know that you're not going to fly off the handle, accuse them of lying, so on and so forth. So laying the groundwork is really important. And then once you get to the point, at whatever age, if you think that your kid has a substance abuse issue or a mental health disorder or some, you know, behaviors that you're concerned about, then you're able to go to them and say, you know, hey, I'm concerned about you. What's going on? What are you up to?
Great question. Great question. Finally, just a few seconds here. Florence, Meghan Markle getting shame for the way she's holding her baby. I feels like she can do no right anymore. I'm kind of on her side now. I feel like she just everything she does is wrong. Do you see anything wrong with that?
No, I don't. Everyone needs to stop it. I mean, she's a good mother. She's a good person. Leave her alone. I mean, stop shaming each other. Lift each other up.
All right. I like that as a final thought. Florence Ann Romano, the Windy City Nanny. Find her at WindyCityNanny.com. And also Rachel Cazes. She has founded an organization called All Along. Check it out. allalong.org, the place to go for helping you understand mental health and finding care when you need it. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Nice to see you both. Coming up here, the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Back live in the Skyline studio, and a lovely lady, Kate Coughlin, has stepped into the studio. She's going to tell you about living your best life and some interesting advice. She's a coach on... Kate, tell us what you're a coach for.
So I do coaching, workshops, and speaking around what I call the bonus life.
The bonus life.
Yes.
Okay.
And when I thought of this was after seeing the Dalai Lama on a panel. And what struck me was not what the Dalai Lama said, but what another woman on the panel said, which was that no time in history and nowhere else on the planet do we have this extra time of longevity. And it really is an extra adulthood that we're able to enjoy. And so I feel that's a bonus life that we can really have a new perspective on.
How did you discover the bonus life and what brought you to that realization that this exists?
Well, the fact that we have this extra time, I think as a society, we've talked a lot about how we need to save more for retirement or we need to worry about assisted care and that sort of thing. And that's such a small part of what that extra time really means. And as a society, we've decided that, you know, as college students, we have these education and other support to kind of think about what that future might look like. And I think at this time in life, in your 40s and 50s and beyond, we need to reassess who we are and what are our skills and our talents and our values and our purpose so that we can live that extra time in a meaningful way.
So that used to be called midlife crisis. You wouldn't call it that.
I don't. I don't think it needs to be a crisis. I think it needs to be really thought of as a really wonderful opportunity to reassess who we are and how we can make an impact in a different way. We have such different criteria about what we want to do with our lives at this time versus when we were in our 20s. So I just think that it's an exciting opportunity. And I think There's an author named Barbara Scher who says that isolation is the dream killer. And I think if we can have ways to come together in community and with other people to talk about these opportunities, I think that's a lot easier than doing it on your own as well.
Okay, so you coach people on how to live their bonus lives.
That's right.
And what do you do? How do you coach someone to get there?
Well, I think there's three stools to approaching this. One is to really look at yourself and do that self-assessment that I referenced in terms of who you are, what are your skills, the wisdom you've acquired over this time, and what are some things that are interesting to you, and how you might like to think about your legacy in this extra time of life. And then because we're kind of pioneers as a boomer generation for this extra time, how can we find the resources and have the support, as I mentioned, of a community of other people? Mm-hmm. So bringing people together, I do workshops as well, so we can come together and talk through these issues. I mean, there is ageism, there is a lot of other obstacles, and so how do we kind of work through all that and still be able to hold on to a dream that we might have for this time?
It feels like finding a purpose in life is so important at any age, just to feel the motivation to do something. I was reading the book Blue Zones, and it's about the healthiest places on earth. They go to these communities all over the globe where they find the people who live the longest, but they also tend to live happy lives, and they live simple lives. These are not wealthy communities, and there's a diet component to it, but there's also a purpose component to it. And whether that's tending to your sheep or being part of your community group or just getting a group of people together every week to read or do whatever you like to do or talk about books, whatever that is, it seems as if the people who lived in these zones all kind of connect to that message. And that's sort of kind of what you're talking about here.
Exactly. I think purpose and community are two really important things to help us have more longevity, but also and then make that time, that extra time, more worthwhile as well. So there's also some workshops that I do at a new space in Winnetka called Gathering for Her. And I have partners Paula Mazinski and Stephanie Vlahakis. And it's a beautiful facility. It's a gallery, an art gallery. So there's this creativity around you as you're thinking creatively about your life. So
what can people do if they want to link up with you, Kate Coughlin, in this gathering? There's a capital H-E-R, but that mean an H-I-M is still invited?
You know, we are typically doing things just for women at Gathering, but I also do other workshops in other locations. So if you want to contact me directly, it's ourbonuslives@gmail.com and also ourbonuslives.org. And then you can contact us at Gathering at gatheringforher@gmail.
All right. Kate Coughlin, thank you for sharing your message with us, and people know how to reach you. Thank you for that.
That's thank you so much,
very
Anna.
Positive thing to think about.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right. We also want to tell you right now, shifting gears a little bit, we want to head to our affiliate in Peoria because Jamie Toler is going to be talking with us in a few minutes here about the party that's going on in Peoria that has to do with smoking weed and then doing art together. Kate, you're still here. Is that something you would advocate? Is that a kind of group that you think is sort of finding a purpose in life?
Why not?
It's
no judgment
now.
At all.
Do you find that people are sort of like, okay, you know, hey, this is what I'm into. This is what I'm gonna do.
I think it's really important not to have judgment around this. There's so much that we can do with this time in life, and it's really important that we not have judgment and then really just think about what it is that we want to do. It's really a wonderful time to have opened up to possibilities.
So when people come to you, do you say, hey, give us your passion? Tell us what it is that motivates you, or how do you start that whole conversation?
Well, I think passion can be a loaded word. I think if you start really with what are your interests, what are your values, what are your skills, kind of step away from the roles that you've played and think about them in maybe a new context or a new way of living, and then go from there and kind of be creative around what that might look like for yourself. Really, it's really, for me, about being very intentional about this time and not just thinking of it as an extension of your life, but really as a new adult life stage like we do when we enter our 20s. I think thinking about this extra adult life stage is something very intentionally to consider and think about in a new way is the important thing.
It's true, because you think about in your 20s, you've got these dreams of what you want to do, and then if you don't necessarily achieve those dreams, or if you change what you kind of want, you think sometimes, oh, I'm too old for that, I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to stay where I am.
Right.
Much easier to sort of stay where you are and not do that. Yesterday on the Noon Business Hour, they featured a man who started a company in his 60s, and he's been so successful and so happy with it. And people looked at him and said, are you serious? Really? You're going to start something now? Most people your age are thinking about sort of hanging things up or slowing down, or maybe at least looking at retirement, you know, if you can afford it and get there sometime soon, but certainly not switching gears entirely.
Well, and I think that's what I'm suggesting that we might want to think about, because it is an extra 20 years or so. And if you're going to be healthy and active and engaged with life, why not be doing that with something that really has meaning and purpose for you? And you're right. I don't think you can ever be too old. There's so many examples of folks who have done things and remarkable things at later in life. And now there's more of us. We are a generation who will be more of us. And so we have some role models, but we're going to be becoming more of the role models. And so hopefully OK Boomer will turn into something much more exciting, like, because we're the examples
yeah,
of how
Boomer,
to live this way.
Right?
Right, exactly.
Big lives to lead. Bonus lives to lead.
Exactly.
Our bonus lives. @gmail.com. That's Kate Coughlin. She's a coach, tried to teach you how to live your own bonus life, and get connected with her through ourbonuslives@gmail.com. There's that gathering for her at gmail.com as well. Do you have a website or anything?
We don't have a website yet, but the bonus lives we do. I have a bonuslives.org okay. as well.
Check it out. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Kate.
Thank you so much, Anna.
Good to talk to you now. We're going to head to Peoria, that story I talked about, and a number of people are getting together for these parties where they smoke marijuana and they do artwork together, and the whole thing seems really strange, but Jamie Toller at our affiliate WMBD in Peoria here to describe a little more about it. Jamie, so this is something you guys are talking about in your newsroom today. Tell us what this is about. It seems kind of
sure
unusual.
Yeah, it's been actually quite the topic of conversation today. You know, you've heard of the wine and paint nights where you bring a bottle of wine and do some painting with friends, and this is essentially that, but a woman here in Peoria is doing this out of her home, because right now recreational marijuana you can only smoke in a residence, so she's kind of giving people the place to gather and do that and be creative.
It's so, has it happened already or is it still happening? It's called Puff and Paint Peoria. Puff and Paint Peoria.
Yes.
And the woman in the story actually is remaining anonymous. Does she feel like there's a stigma around this that she doesn't really want to come forward, or has that changed?
She still is remaining quite private. And she said that the gathering started actually back on January 1 when recreational marijuana came into effect here in Illinois. And I was looking through some of her upcoming events. They seem to be pretty popular. Many of them are selling out. And her Facebook page says, bring your best buds, pun intended, and kind of just enjoy this. And our sheriff actually weighed in, too, to a reporter here in Peoria, saying it's kind of a gray area as far as the legality of her hosting this, but he doesn't see any legal issues with it. He's just, again, reminding people, obviously, not to drive while high.
Yes, an important reminder. We talk about that all the time with the recreational marijuana becoming legal. So they check the IDs at the door, make sure you're 21, and you can bring your own weed. They don't provide it, and then you go and you paint together. Have you seen the artwork? How does this artwork look, Jamie? Let's be honest.
Some of the pictures I've seen, you know, I would not paint well, high or otherwise, I'm sure. but some people are very skilled, and I think, you know, a lot of us have inhibitions, and maybe if you're high, you can be a little more relaxed and let your creativity go wild on the canvas. So it's certainly something interesting, obviously something we haven't seen before because this is so new across the state, but it's pretty interesting so far. She seems to be getting a good response based on the Facebook posts I've seen. So something very interesting popping up here in Peoria for sure.
No question. Jamie Toller from WMBD in Peoria, our affiliate down there. Thank you for checking in with us on that.
Thank you.
Coming up here, trending stories on WGN, including the move to try to change Super Bowl Sunday to Super Bowl Saturday, the petition that's circulating, and Roger Goodell's response to it, plus Amazon's secret outlet store. Did you know there was one? Major discounts that few people really know much about. So it's all coming up here on WGN. When you look back at 2019, what stands out for you? If the answer to that is depression, anxiety, and hopelessness, remember this is a new year and a fresh start awaits you. Anesthesiologist Dr. Bal Nandra uses ketamine to treat major depression. Ketamine is safe, and in lower doses, it can quickly relieve depression and anxiety. Can also provide relief from PTSD and chronic pain. Ketamine has been called the greatest advancement in mental health in decades. Many antidepressants are not effective or have bad side effects, but ketamine treatments from Dr. Nandra could reduce or eliminate your need for a lot of those drugs. Most people find relief in just a few hours or days. Treatment involves 6 IV infusions over 2 weeks in a private monitored setting. They now also offer the highly effective SGB treatment. It's for PTSD. Schedule your free consultation calling 844-9-IVY-MEDS. That's 844-9-IVY-MEDS or visit KetamineChicago.com. That's KetamineChicago.com. All right, Lauren Lapka has stepped into the studio here because we're doing trending topics. And there are a number of sports stories that I think will appeal to you, including that Super Bowl moving it to Saturday from Sunday. So we'll talk about that. But first, this is interesting. If you get a text from FedEx, do not click on the link unless you totally recognize it and you're going to have a package delivered. Did you see this new scam?
Yeah, they're getting very smart. Smarter and smarter.
This one looks so... You're right. I would fall for this one. Mm-hmm. They even use your name in some cases. Your real name. And so they... gotten a lot of information about you. Police are warning of this texting scam where it takes you to a link. You click on a link, and then that link is a fake Amazon page, and it offers you to take a free survey. So once the survey, part of the survey involves you putting in your credit card information.
What?
Yeah, that's...
people, come on.
As Steve Burness likes to say from the Better Business Bureau, the tip-off to the rip-off right there. And then you're supposed to receive a product for a charge of $98. So they're asking for money. They're asking for your credit card information. FedEx says, we never ask for that stuff. That's not going to happen. So if you do get a text, you're not expecting a package, or even if you are and you're not sure, that link is just not something you should click on because it's a phishing scam. All right. So would you like to own a piece of Frank Sinatra's Golden Nugget Chairman Suite? They're putting a lot of this stuff on auction, Lauren. It's like, I guess Frank Sinatra owned a golden toilet where he sat on one. He did not own. He sat on it when he would stay in Atlantic City and perform. This was his suite.
Oh,
so it's
okay.
This really kind of over-the-top golden suite, which has a bronze chandelier, this Art Deco-style headboard to a bed. There's a Grecian garden statue and all kinds of things, Buddha statues. Lots of different, multiple toilets, a bidet.
Wow, he really had an active bathroom life, I guess.
Apparently did. He used a lot of, he had multiple toilets, a bidet, and those are all up for auction if you want something that Frank Sinatra once used.
Well, I'm sure those will go for quite a lot of money.
Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of one of those things that seems sort of silly and weird, but then you look at how much it sells for, you're like, what?
Yeah, you got those collectors out there. They are willing to spend a lot of money.
How is that possible? Right, so, okay, have you ever heard of this? Amazon has a secret outlet mall with hidden bargains that could save you hundreds of dollars. Some products up to 80% off original price and that kind of thing. So it's a separate section of the retail giant, and you have to find it on the actual site. But there's an outlet mall that gives you, it's an outlet page. So you look for the outlet page. You can search for it in the search bar to try to find this, where it's kind of like discounted merchandise, a bunch of stuff, just like regular stores, how they try to get rid of stuff.
Just finding out about this.
I had no idea. But then again, I get lost on Amazon, don't you? There's just too much stuff.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you plug in something you're looking for, and suddenly you're looking for something you were not looking for, and then you're moving all over the place.
And it puts you into like certain departments. So when you were searching for maybe a book, all of a sudden you're in the pets section, and so it's only giving you... books about pets, and you're so confused of why they're so popular right now. That happened to me when I was Christmas shopping.
Oh, were you shopping for anything pet related at all? Nothing.
Well, actually, yeah. Eventually, I was looking for something for my sister's dog. So
that did it. That's now your search history, and they know it, and they know you. So Amazon outlet, search for that if you want to get some big deals. Netflix is out with the number one viewed season one ever. For Netflix, and it's a show I have never heard of, The Witcher.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I knew you might know about this.
I've seen this being advertised on Netflix. You know how they like to have their shows pop up first?
Their suggestions.
Yeah, and I never actually watched the preview, so I don't know what it's about, but I have heard about it.
It looks kind of Game of Thronesian.
Oh.
If you see the characters, they look sort of medieval fantasy.
I know there's a game called The Witcher, and I wonder if it's...
maybe
connected.
Built on that. But so it's weird because it's the most viewed ever season one, but they change the way they measure that stuff. So if you view for at least 2 minutes, that's long enough to indicate that it was an intentional viewing or something. They changed the whole thing. It used to be you had to watch more of the actual show. Now they say if you just watch 2 minutes, that counts. So The Witcher is something that, I don't know, a lot of people are checking out apparently, at least for 2 minutes.
You could use a new show, I guess.
Exactly. I could. Game of Thrones is over.
I know, it's depressing.
And yeah, we both got into that very much. So this maybe The Witcher.
But The Outsider and Curb.
That's where
Big
Curb
fan.
Is back.
Yes.
I saw the first episode of Curb. Totally enjoy seeing Larry David fret about absolutely everything and nothing.
Right.
So entertaining. Remember Mr. Peanut from Planters Peanuts fame?
Mm-hmm.
He's dead.
What? Mm-hmm. How's that possible?
He is 104-year-old spokesnut, Mr. Peanut, no longer representing the brand following his passing. So they had a tweet that kind of announced it the other day. It's with heavy hearts that we confirm Mr. Peanut has died at 104.
How did he go?
Mr. Peanut tweeted with the account newly named the estate of Mr. Peanut. So he has an estate. Well, you would. I mean, he's been in the business of spokesnutship for a long time.
Yeah, you could tell he's got money. He's got like that top hat and the monocle.
Oh, yeah. He looks like total money. In the ultimate selfless act, he sacrificed himself to save his friends when they need him most. Please pay your respects. Now, the whole thing, by the way, is going to the funeral will be held during the Super Bowl. Isn't that perfect marketing and advertising?
Oh, goodness.
So, yeah, they're going to have a Super Bowl ad with Mr. Peanut and the estate of Mr. Peanut. And it's a 30-second ad. So watch for that. I think there's a car accident. His nutmobile gets into a car accident. So that's one of the Super Bowl ads to watch out for. Then did you hear about this? The teenager who's trying to get the Super Bowl moved to Saturday.
I'm either for that or we take Monday off.
Yeah, you know, so people have suggested that in the past, right? Mm-hmm. Make it a national holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, how many people, 100 million people watch the Super Bowl? It's like practically a third of America, a lot of America. Well, why wouldn't you make Monday a holiday? Okay, do we have too many holidays? Move it to Saturday. He's got a change.org petition that he launched, and he's got like 25,000 people who have already signed it. And it's growing by the minute as, you know, more information gets out about what he's trying to do. He's 16. So he's like, you know, how about the Super Bowl be on Saturday?
Yeah, because just like a lot of kids, he's probably frustrated that every time he's up late because, again, people have a bunch of parties, and then he has to wake up early for school, and he's extra tired. That's not fun.
And he's probably worth nothing, like a lot of us are, after our Super Bowl party. 17 million U.S. employees miss work the day after the Super Bowl.
Yeah, miss work. I believe it.
That's just sort of not showing up, you know, the fake sick thing, the Super Bowl-itis. Like, that's what's going on. So it's interesting because we've heard of these things before, right? They've talked about it in the past. Like, let's change it to Saturday. It totally makes sense. It's America's pastime. People love the Super Bowl. We're all watching it. Why make us all stay up so late? Or else move the time back.
Right.
What about that?
Yeah, that also makes sense. Because I get why, in a lot of ways, they wouldn't want to put it on a Saturday because restaurants and bars and all kinds of places are getting a lot of extra cash that day, that Sunday, when most places are usually booming and busy on Saturdays anyways.
Yeah.
So
by the way, Roger Goodell has weighed in on this, and he says there will absolutely not be a Saturday Super Bowl. You know why?
Why?
Basically, it comes down to one main thing, and that main thing, this is his quote, comes down to one main thing, and that main thing is television ratings.
Ugh, yeah. Well, I guess that makes sense, too, because a lot of times people are busy or doing something on a Saturday. Sunday, you're starting to wind down and get ready for the work week or school.
Yeah, I guess Sunday night, they just get monster ratings that they feel like they wouldn't get on a Saturday. But I feel like if you had Super Bowl on a Saturday, wouldn't people?
Yeah, people still make appointment viewing.
Yeah, totally.
Whatever, Roger.
Yeah, whatever, Roger. He's not that popular anyway, so whatever.
No.
But anyway, so we have this one more thing here. You've heard about the emotional support animals and how everything seems to pass as an emotional support animal these days, and the airlines are cracking down on that. They don't like that idea. Well, a man just tried to pass his beer off as a service animal. He's trying to register the service animal. He filled out a form to register his service animal as, quote, a 16-ounce, lightly hopped session IPA served in a regular bar pint glass. He says that it's a federal crime to smoke or have an alcohol beverage, taking one onto the plane, unless by prior written consent. So he says this is his way around it. I mean, I know you can have a beer on the plane.
I'm curious to see if that works. Yeah, and if you bought, you know, bottles of liquor in the airport, you can bring it on, but you cannot open and drink your own liquor.
Right. Okay, that must be the difference here. He says, I'm not an alcoholic. It's just an experiment trying to make light of any, and also not trying to make light of anybody with emotional issues. I just wanted to see if I could do it. And by the way, I have not been approached by anyone, and it seems to have worked for him.
What?
Yes.
That's so crazy.
It is so crazy. That shows you how crazy it's getting. All right, we're going to talk to Rokan. He's not crazy. He's going to tell us what's coming up on his show, 3 to 7, today on WGN. And we're going to hear from the news. Steve Bertram will bring you your news. I'm sorry, Kim Gordon will bring you the news at the top of the hour from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.